This is Joyce Vesper, your Sun Sounds of Arizona Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster. Today I'll be reading another couple of chapters from Tales of Al, The Water Rescue Dog, The Making of a Super Athlete by Lynn Cox, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles from some newsletters and some magazines about the animals in our lives. I'm going to begin today's readings with Tales of Al by Lynn Cox. In the previous chapter, we learned that Lynn had met Zack, who was a lovely old dog who looked like a lion. He actually is what's known as a lion burger breed. He was sweet but failing, and Al knew that Zack was not in the best of shape. The two, however, enjoyed each other's company, and like old friends, they lay cuddling together. Chapter 12, Dogs Under the Table. Leaving Al behind, Donatella drove me to a nearby trattoria to meet with Ferruccio and Roberto, his friend and fellow instructor, for dinner. We did not talk much along the way. Donatella seemed focused on other thoughts. She mentioned that she and Bob, another instructor from the school, were taking Al to Genoa in the morning. They were planning to meet with the Guardia Consigliera to put Al through a test. She invited me to join them. She had mentioned the trip when we spoke on the phone when I was in California. I said then I would love to go, but she now appeared conflicted and stressed. Maybe it was challenging for her to translate Italian to English for me. She parked the car and we walked into a cozy restaurant with small tables covered with white tablecloths. Delicate vases with yellow roses and dark green fern adorned each table, and small white candles lit the room with warm amber light. As we walked through the restaurant, a server opened the kitchen door. The aroma of garlic, rosemary, and warm bread floated into the air. It smelled delicious. Sitting at tables were people who looked like locals. Women wore summer dresses, and men in light-colored shirts and pants. Donatella weaved between the tables, stopping to ask if I would mind sitting outside. It was warm and calm, and the sky was clear blue. Silvery green-leafed olive trees framed the patio, and long strands of white lights hung from the branches. Donatella explained that Ferruccio and Roberto planned to bring their dogs, and there was not enough room for them inside the restaurant. They were waiting for us at a table, and Roberto said he thought I would enjoy the trattoria. It was one of their favorites. The owner was a friend and a big fan of lifeguard dogs. He also reserved a table for them. They also selected the restaurant because it served food made from local and regional recipes. Sitting in the open air, talking about dogs and Italy, and enjoying delicious food sounded perfect to me. But I was so focused on where we were going to sit that I did not notice the three Newfoundlands lying down by the other side of the table. Maz was on the floor beside Ferruccio, and there were two beautiful black and white Newfoundlands beside Roberto. Resting on their bellies to feel the coolness of the tile floor, they looked like giant bear rugs. "We hope you don't mind if the dogs sit near the table," Roberto said with some hesitation. "Having a dog under the table makes me feel like I'm at home," I said. "Really? I thought Americans did not like having dogs around their table," he said, surprised. "My family always had dogs, and they were always under the table at dinner time. I had a Dalmatian named Beth, and if we had liver for dinner, I sneaked it under the table for her. I had to do it carefully and hope that she did not make too much of a noise when she ate, or I would get in trouble." Roberto grinned and said that when he was in school, people came for dinner, and the entire area was filled with dogs. They are all over the place, under the table, around the table. He has two black and white dogs, and they were special types of Newfoundlands called Landseers. They were finer boned with softer fur. They were named after Sir Edwin Landseer, who painted a classic picture of the Landseer dog. Their temperament is like the brown or the brown and black Newfoundland breed. They are sweet, gentle giants and great swimmers, Ferruccio explained. Ferruccio began telling stories of three famous Newfoundland dogs. Boatswain was a Landseer given a puppy to George Gordon Byron, Lord Byron, when he was 15 years old. Lord Byron was one of England's greatest poets and is famous for swimming across the Hellespont, now known as the Dardanelles. Boatswain and his owner were deeply attached. Lord Byron traveled everywhere with boatswain and would spend hours drifting in a boat on the lake on the estate in Newstead Abbey, reading beside his beloved dog. To test boatswain's fidelity, Byron would suddenly jump into the water and boatswain would lip in after him and drag him to shore. When boatswain was bitten by a rabid dog in 1808, a vaccine was not available to save him, but Byron nursed and hand-fed boatswain, unafraid of being bitten and contracting rabies. It broke Lord Byron's heart when boatswain died. He created a monument to the Newfoundland and wrote the heart-wrenching epitaph to a dog to honor him. Near this spot are deposited the remains of one who possessed beauty without vanity, strength without insolence, courage without ferocity, and all the virtues of man without his vices. This praise, which would be unmeaning flattery if inscribed over human ashes, is but a just tribute to the memory of Boatswain, a dog, who was born in Newfoundland, May 1803, and died at Newstead, November 18, 1808. There is something wonderful about Newfoundland dogs. They are devoted and brave and sagacious. President Thomas Jefferson commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark to conduct their extraordinary expedition to explore and map the Louisiana Purchase, the land acquired from France in 1803. Jefferson wanted them to find a water passage through the West to the Pacific with the hope of opening trade with Asia. He encouraged Lewis and Clark to meet the Native Americans to learn about their lives, languages, cultures, and encourage them with trade. Lewis needed a special dog to be a member of his team. He wanted a dog that was large and powerful and a good swimmer. The expedition would travel across dangerous, unexplored lands and waterways on the way to the western frontier. The team needed a dog that would alert them to danger and protect them. Lewis also experienced bouts of severe depression that often led him to be bedridden, and he needed a constant companion. Meriwether Lewis traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to find Seaman, and the dog proved to be a great asset to the team. He hunted with William Clark and drove beavers from their ledges. Clark shot them to feed the team of 45 men and one woman, Sacagawea, a Lemhi Shoshone, who served as an interpreter for the expedition. Clark admired Seaman and his ability to hunt and share. One day, when they were traveling along a river, Seaman saw a herd of pronghorn antelope swimming nearby. He charged into the water, swam over to one antelope, and drowned it. Seaman swam back to shore with it and gave it to Clark, providing much-needed food for the entire expedition. In May 1805, when Seaman was retrieving a wounded beaver from the water, he was bitten. The beaver's bite struck an artery, and Seaman nearly bled to death. Lewis conducted emergency surgery and managed to stop the bleeding, saving Seaman's life. 10 days later, Seaman saved Lewis and others. The expedition team had set up camp for evening and were sleeping outside. Before the sentry could alert the men to danger, an enormous male bison raced through the camp, passing dangerously close to the men and nearly trampling them. The bison continued racing through the camp and was headed for Lewis's tent. Seaman bravely chased the charging animal, forcing him to turn away. He saved Lewis and others that night, and he continued to be their trusted watchdog. One night, Seaman was restless, barking constantly. This was not his normal behavior. The men understood that something was wrong. In the morning, they realized that Seaman had tried to warn them that a bear had come within 10 minutes of the camp and eaten their supply of bison and suet hanging from a pole. Seaman also served as an ambassador to the Native Americans, who had little of any exposure to Anglo-American culture. Lewis said they were cautious about Seaman and they admired his courage. Lewis was fond of Seaman, and it pained him to see his dog suffer hardships along the trail. When Seaman walked between the men, prickly pear cactus growing along the ground struck into his paws. He chewed them and pulled out the large spines, but the smaller ones stuck as he walked. He yelped in agony. On July 15, 1806, Lewis wrote his last journal entry about Seaman, describing how he howled from the pain experienced when swarms of mosquitoes bit him. In spite of many other challenges, Seaman and Lewis and Clark traveled up the Missouri River to its headwaters and reached the Pacific Ocean via the Columbia River. They explored what would become 16 of the United States over a period of 2 years, 4 months, and 10 days. Lewis and Clark and Seaman would travel more than 8,000 miles across the North American continent and back. In 1819, when the official account of the Lewis and Clark expedition was published, Timothy Alden, a clergyman and member of the New York Historical Society, wrote about Seaman. In his collection of American epitaphs and inscriptions with occasional notes, he included the text on a dog collar that was in a museum in Alexandria, Virginia. The inscription read, "The greatest traveler of my species. My name is Seaman, the dog of Captain Meriwether Lewis, whom I accompanied to the Pacific Ocean through the interior of the continent of North America." Alden noted that Seaman was still wearing the collar when he returned from the west coast of America. Seaman's fidelity and attachment to Lewis was extraordinary. After Lewis passed away, Seaman would not part from his remains for a moment, and no one could move Seaman from the spot where Lewis was buried. Seaman refused any food offered him, pined away, and died from grief on Lewis's grave. He was always Lewis's best friend. Another famous Newfoundland was actually from Newfoundland. Harry Mann was part of a daring rescue. On July 10, 1828, the Dispatch, a large brig sailing from Derry Island to Quebec, Canada, with 200 passengers and 11 crew, was caught in a ferocious storm. Ice, gale, force winds, and fierce seas made navigation extremely difficult. Near Île aux Morts, on the southwest coast of Newfoundland, the brig struck a submerged rock and broke up rapidly. Captain Lancaster and some passengers were drowned when a massive wave swamped one of the lifeboats. 3 days later, Anne Harvey, a 17-year-old girl, and her father George were fishing nearby. Anne noticed a keg and a bed floating in heavy seas and realized that there had been a shipwreck. She and her father ran home to alert her younger brother and Harry Mann, their Newfoundland. The Harveys launched their dory and rowed into the heavy seas through tremendous swells. After 2 hours of exhausting effort, they found a group of survivors clinging to the rocks of a tiny island 5 kilometers from the mainland. The waves and storm surge were so great and threatening that George could not get the boat closer than 30 meters from the rocks. Harry Mann jumped into the terrifying waves and swam to the rocks, where he grabbed a piece of wood in his mouth and carried it back to the dory. The Harveys tied a rope to the wood, and Harry Mann swam it back to the stranded men so that they could create a lifeline to get to the dory. They were pulled aboard and rowed to shore. For 3 days, the Harveys returned to the shipwreck many times and saved 163 people. They took the survivors home and fed them all their winter provisions. For their extraordinary life-saving efforts, the Harveys received a bravery award from the Royal Canadian Humane Association. The memory of the Harvey family and the hairy dog continue today. In 1987, the Canadian Coast Guard commissioned a ship named Anne Harvey that is used for buoy tending, icebreaking, and research and rescue along the Canadian coast. And Ferrucci finished the stories, and we returned our attention to the meal. I realized that dining in Italy was different from eating in the United States. We would be served at least 3 courses. Dinner would take 2 hours, possibly 3, maybe more, giving us time to relax and enjoy good food and long conversation. Donatella was listening, but her eyes looked like she was far away and thinking about something else. She said something rapidly in Italian to Ferruccio and Roberto and mentioned Zach and Alan said, "Domani, domani," meaning tomorrow. She explained that she had a lot to accomplish before we traveled to Genoa in the morning and should go, but Ferruccio and Roberto convinced her to stay for dinner. Chapter 13, A Toast and Beans. Ferruccio offered a toast, "Salut." Raising our small glasses, we answered, "Salut," and sipping sparkling wine. It was from Franciacorta region. Grown locally in the glacier-scoured soil, the grape vines absorbed the essence of earth and flourished in the summer sunshine. The color of wine was different from where I had seen, pale yellow with light green tones. It was lightly sweet and fruity, like crisp yellow apples, peaches, and apricots. We sipped the wine, and Roberto asked me about the Southern California Newfoundlands. Before we met, they thought that was my first experience with Newfoundland dogs, but I had told them that I had often babysat 3 of them for friends in California. Jacqueline and Brian, my friends, had 2 Landseers, one named Pork, the other named Beans. Pork was male, and Beans was female. The men thought it was strange that someone would name their dogs Pork and Beans. It was odd. They looked uncertain. Ferruccio asked Roberto to translate what I said again to make sure he understood. He asked if it was common to name dogs in the United States Pork and Beans. Wasn't that something Americans eat from a can? Their faces tightened. They scowled and looked perplexed. They were more familiar with dignified names. Most dogs in Italy were named after people of importance and places of note. Pork and Beans was an unusual name for dogs, I agreed. Roberto chuckled and asked, what would someone name a dog after a canned food for? Ferruccio grinned. He translated their names in Italian, Mariali e Fagioli, he said, and tightened his lips, trying to suppress his laughter. But when he saw me smiling and heard Roberto's belly laugh and saw tears running down his cheeks, Ferruccio burst into laughter. Between laughing and catching his breath, he tested more humorous names, Parma, Prosciutto, Vienna, ham, dried ham, come, Fagioli, he said, between ripples of laughter. Finally, I caught my breath and explained that I had asked Brian the same question. He said the names made people smile. Pork and Beans complimented each other like good friends. He gave them an unusual name because he wanted them to be distinctive. For a moment, Ferruccio and Roberta grew serious. They understood the importance of making sure that they were clear when they spoke to their dogs, especially in situations where they were involved in water rescues. They thought it was clever that Brian would give them such names and the names would be unique. Ferruccio asked me to tell them more about Pork and Beans. Jacqueline and Brian lived in Emerald Bay, an idyllic beachside community in Southern California. Everyone in the neighborhood knew Pork and Beans and Otis, their older sibling, who has an enormous black Newfoundland. Traveling anywhere with them was challenging. The dogs were huge celebrities. When neighbors saw the three dogs outside, they would immediately stop whatever they were doing to say hello. The dogs loved attention. They would gently sniff the little children, let them pet them, and hug them. They carefully encircled children so all that could be seen were their huge faces and the tiny faces of the laughing children. The dogs would kick and lick the children and were careful not to knock them over. Being with them and watching the way people responded was like listening to Beethoven's Ode to Joy, a celebration of unity and humanity. When Brian and Jacqueline left on a trip, they calmly said goodbye to their dogs. After they drove away, the dogs followed me everywhere. It was not out of sense of anxiety. They just wanted to see what I was doing. They were extremely curious and seemed so well-behaved. When I prepared their meals, a mixture of lean ground beef, cooked oatmeal, and special vitamins, they sat patiently. Donatella asked how often they were fed, and I told her twice a day. Donatella said that Al ate at 7 in the morning and 7 at night, and was fed a protein food so she did not have to change her diet when she traveled. That would be a stress on her body. Canadian dog food she bought was distributed all over the world. She added that Al had a voracious appetite and vacuumed up her food. As Donatella could not feed her in a smooth bowl, she had to put Al's food in a 3-cylinder container to slow her consumption. She would eat anything but bananas and anything with that texture. She didn't have any problems eating with other dogs because in the time it took to count to 5, she would have finished her meal. She could eat right beside another dog, and there wouldn't be any problem. I asked Donatella if she ever gave Al prosciutto, salami, or pancetta as a special treat. Donatella, Roberto, and Ferruccio shook their heads. Ferruccio said they never fed their dogs Italian cold cuts because they were full of sodium and they could damage the dog's kidneys, and he asked how much ground meat I fed Otis, Pork, and Beans. I said I gave them a large handful of the meat and oats mixture. After Otis, Pork, and Beans finished eating, I brushed them, each waited for their turn, and luxuriated in the attention. They sighed as I brushed them loose of their fur and shiny coats, and they snuggled close to me when I ran my hands around their faces and over their bodies to check for foxtail, seed, and other grass seeds that could bury into their skin and cause infection. Every day I was with them, I worked on my first book, Swimming to Antarctica, and the dogs stayed with me. They kept me company, and it felt like they were watching over me. Ferruccio was listening closely to me and said, "That is how Newfoundlands are." I continued with my story. Beans lay near the deck by my feet. Pork rested just beyond her, and Otis lay partly in the doorway to the office and partly in the hallway. They were sentries. No one could enter or leave the room unless the dog let them pass. They would open their eyes often and scan the area. I felt safe with them. The dogs needed a lot of exercise to work off energy and stay physically and mentally healthy. We took a long walk each morning when it was cool and another one in the evening. I hooked them up to their leashes and let them choose the direction. They always chose a path that went through the residential area toward the beach, and they were well behaved. But one day I decided to take them on a more inland route so that they would not be bored and I could explore more of the community. When they realized that we were taking the inland route, Otis, Pork, and Beans started huffing and puffing and hyperventilating with excitement. I should have expected something was going to happen. We started our walk at a brisk pace, and when we reached a fork in the road and took the left branch, the dogs lifted their heads, perked their ears, and raised their fur on their backs to make themselves appear larger. It seemed, or I sensed, that they were preparing for something big and threatening, but I did not see any signs of trouble. No one was on the street, no dogs or cats were roaming free, and there was no mail truck or mail carrier in the area. Then in the distance, I heard a muffled bark. The dogs heard it, they started walking faster, and they pulled me harder. I told them to wait in a commanding voice. They slowed to a trot, and I thought I had them under control. We continued walking with Otis in the lead and Beans and Pork on the either side of him. But as we turned a sharp corner, a barrage of loud snarling barks erupted somewhere from behind us. Otis barked once to signal a charge. The three dogs lunged forward, nearly ripping their leashes from my grasp. I grabbed the leashes with both hands and held as tightly as I could. The dogs were breathing hard and fast. I was stumbling behind them, trying to catch my breath. I told them to stop, but they did not obey. They continued pulling me, just like Al and Donatella. Otis, Beans, and Pork were running toward a pale yellow Spanish-style mansion. A white-colored Cairn Terrier leapt from the top step of the doorway and ran to the gate. Otis, Pork, and Beans saw the white flash and started running fast. The Cairn Terrier was leaping up and down the steps, barking so hard he had to stop and catch his breath. I could not understand why a dog that small would agitate three Newfoundlands. I shouted their names, but they only seemed to hear the terrier. Climbing to the top step to make sure his voice carried farther, the terrier barked and barked and snarled. Otis, Pork, and Beans were infuriated by the terrier's bark, and it had become their single mission to silence him. I was shouting at Otis, Pork, and Beans, telling them to stop and sit, but they did not hear me. I had to figure out how to control the three Newfoundlands. I couldn't believe my feet could move so fast. I was breathing hard, my lungs felt like they were on fire, and sweat was running down my face. The Cairn Terrier released a barrage of barks, and Otis, Beans, and Pork snapped into a faster gear. I stumbled and fell, but I would not let go of the leashes. I did not want the dogs to get loose and hurt that terrier. I arched my back and lifted my head to keep my face from scraping across the asphalt. It was strange. At first, it was fun. It was like being a child again, sliding headfirst down a snowy hill at a full speed, being on the edge of control and watching the world fly by like it was fast forward. But the exhilaration only lasted a few minutes. Having absorbed the heat from the morning sun, the asphalt was hot and the friction caused my body moving across the pavement, burned through my clothing. The road tar smelled sickeningly sweet, and my perception of space, time, and distance was altered. The road that I had driven on that had appeared flat to me was now sloped. Unnoticed cracks had become wide chasms, and gentle depressions became large potholes. Patches of shattered white and green glass, sharp twigs, hard pebbled-sized eucalyptus seeds, and abrasive sand hurt me. Scraping along the road was becoming very painful. Telling Pork, Beans, and Otis to stop was not working. It is amazing how quickly the mind can work, how fast it can bring forth a multitude of memories, sort through them, and mine them for vital information. I suddenly remembered Martin Boucher, a friend who won the Iditarod 4 times with his champion sled dog. Next time, we will read Chapter 14, Focaccia and the Iditarod, in the book Tales of Al, The Water Rescue Dog, The Making of a Super Athlete by Lynn Cox. Well, that completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time when we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.